And hello, welcome to Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell joining you this morning. It's our Friday talk back on RN, and today we're rocking and rolling with this question. What's in a name? What's in your name? Why do you have the name you do? Is it the right name for you? Perhaps you've changed your name for a very particular reason. Our name is usually the first thing we share about ourselves, and it comes wrapped up in a complex parcel of family history and heritage, identity, expectations, even some baggage, possibly too. Marketeers might think of our names as a kind of branding. Do you have an interesting nickname? How'd you get it? And also, what do you think of the tradition of women taking their husband's surname when they marry? If you're a woman, did you have a personal reason for doing that? Or did you keep your own name? Perhaps you're a man who's taken your partner's name instead. Tell us why. Then there's the vexed and newer issue of hyphenated surnames, combining yours and theirs. What are your kids then going to do when they have kids? And what about the kids' kids when they have kids and so on? Perhaps you've decided to liberate yourself from your family name for personal reasons or to change your first name by deepole. It's an effort often people make to redefine themselves. And then, of course, there are pseudonyms. This week, a nasty case of bullying by trolls on Twitter has renewed calls that people use their actual name online instead of hiding behind the mask of a pseudonym. But perhaps you have a pseudonym that works very well for you. The novelist George Eliot did. So many interesting names, so many interesting stories behind them. Love you to share some of them with us this morning. Ring us 1300 225 76. That's 1300 call RN. 1300 225 76. If you're in South Australia and NT, we'll need you to call right now to beat those time zones. And listeners in Western Australia, get on our listener line 02 833 1430, 02 833 1430. You can leave a number there. We're on Twitter too. We're going to track this along. I know one of our guests, Stilgarian, has a big Twitter following, so tune in, folks. And our Twitter address is at RN Life Matters. That's at RN Life Matters. We're on Facebook. Just search, go to facebook.com/RN Life Matters. And there's our website too, abc.net.au/radionational/Life Matters. Many ways to leave comments as you're listening to the discussion. So we're wondering why our names are intimately wrapped up in our identity. And clinical psychologist Amanda Gordon joins me first. And she's the director of the Sydney practice Armchair Psychology. And I think we also have Stilgarian on the line, commentator and politics and technology writer with outlets like Crikey, New Matilda and ABC's The Drum. He joins us on Skype from San Francisco. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Natasha.
Excellent. I'm glad we got that Skype line working well. Stilgarian, I'll start with you. Stilgarian is your full name. You have no surname. When did you make the decision to change your name to Stilgarian?
Well, Natasha, we're talking something like 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago. The name itself was coined by a friend of mine just out of his head when we were at university. This is, you know, the end of the 70s, so no one really has any kind of clear memory of exactly what was going on or why. But the name kind of was part of the milieu of a little circle of friends, if I can use that kind of language this early in the morning.
It's sounding a bit like a Dungeons and Dragons name, I thought, or a role-playing name.
Yeah, well, it's not, but this little group of people connected with the computing science department at Adelaide University were, in fact, fantasy role-playing gamers. So, yes, but there was an interest in names and power. And in fact, one of the most kind of popular fantasy books of the period was by Ursula Le Guin.
Oh,
it's a trilogy called the Earthsea Trilogy.
Yes,
you know it.
Yes, I read it, all of it.
Well, the whole core running through that is that in that world, the world of Earthsea, everyone had a name that everyone used, but also a true name, which only the person who named them knew. And that name contained all of the power, a bit like, Samson and his hair. But so the idea that what you called something and the power of language was important. And we had a group of friends, some of whom were studying linguistics. Olympics as well. So the name kind of was coined to sound right. And long story short, I eventually decided to adopt it legally, and the word Stilgherrian sounded best by itself than mixed up with any other elements of my former name. So there it is, a one-word name, and I've survived with that for more than 30 years.
So, and this is a question I want to ask too, and someone on Twitter is asking it. Wonder if Stilgherrian's parents minded that he's no longer using the name they chose for him.
Well, look, at the time, my father had long since been dead. He died when I was a kid. But my mother, coming from a traditional rural background, yeah, it took her a while to get used to the idea because traditionally, you know, the name is tied to family and family is tied to, well, so many social and personal connections. So it took probably a good couple of years for her to truly understand in her heart that this change didn't affect the relationship between her and me.
But it did affect how you were placed in terms of the history of the family.
Yes. I don't quite know how that will work. It took a while. I know that there was someone compiling a family history, and I don't, you know, it took them a while to get that right. But to be honest, as it happens for separate reasons, I'm not actually very close to my family, and, you know, I don't really know how that's perceived. But, you know, when I have caught up, I mean, now, you know, we're talking more than three decades later, so they just accept it as a fact.
Yes, and I think many people will resonate with that. Some people very much change their name, in a sense, because they don't have so much of a closeness to family and they want to, I guess, define themselves and their own identity and put a name to themselves. Amanda Gordon, speaking generally, why might it be hard for those close to us, particularly family, to know us by another name that we have defined for ourselves? Why do names matter in the way that they do?
Look, names seem to matter in so many ways for people, Natasha. When parents choose a name for their child, often they're trying to vest their child with various dreams that they have for the future. You know, this child looks like an Amanda means something about what they dream an Amanda might be. So if you divest yourself of that name, you're also saying, I'm not going to share your dreams. I'm going to do something different than the dream you had for me. You had an image of an Amanda who was this, but maybe I feel that and I can't do it with the burden of your dreams on my shoulders.
That's an interesting take. So have you fulfilled all the dreams that your parents had for an Amanda?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because yes, they might have had a dream for an Amanda, but I became Mandy, it seems, within a few weeks. And I had to fight very hard to regain the Amanda. So for the last 30 years I've been Amanda, but before that I wasn't at all. And my parents have found it the hardest to resume the Amanda of the everyone.
The curse of the nickname, Australians and their propensity to nickname
that's
people.
Right. That's right. Look, I guess I'm not talking about me personally. I'm talking about what happens when we choose names. And I think we really do choose carefully. Some people do it in a way that seems provocative or careless, you know, naming someone as the name of a fruit or a season, you know, which seems very odd. But they're doing it in that capricious way because they're trying to say something about what they hope will happen for that child.
Sometimes I feel sorry for those children.
Oh, I must say I do too. I'm actually working with a mother and daughter at the moment, interestingly, and the daughter is 24 and has decided to change her first name, not her surname, her first name. And her mother is finding it incredibly difficult. She wants to please her daughter by using her new name and respecting the fact that she's making a choice about the way she wants to establish her identity. But she is able to express that sense of when I thought of that name and when you were growing up and I used the nicknames that came from that name. It was very significant for me, and I feel like you are throwing off the yoke of my motherhood. And so that's
argue that, you know, the daughter is still the same person, it's just that they're changing their name. But in effect, perhaps she's not the same person, and that's the very point she's trying to express in changing her name.
I think that's right. I think she is trying to say, I have grown and I am different and I need to express myself in this way. You know, I was listening to your commentary about women who change their names when they marry. I and my two sisters were all married in the 70s, and I was the first married and was desperate to change my name because my name was Jones, and I was one of the three Jones girls, And I had to get out of that and give up being one of the three Jones girls. Unfortunately, I chose a name almost as common as Jones to switch to. But my next married sister kept her maiden name as her middle name. And my next married sister hyphenated the names.
Oh,
so we've each chosen a different way of expressing who we are.
Endless variations. Mm. It's a Friday Life Matters Talkback here on RN. Natasha Mitchell with you. And I'm joined by Stilgherrian, tech commentator, political commentator. He's joining us from San Francisco. And Amanda Gordon, clinical psychologist. We're discussing what's in a name and the role that our name has in our life. Perhaps you've changed your name for a very particular reason. Let's come to some calls. Mick from New South Wales. So you took your wife's name.
Hello.
Hello there, Mick. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Hello.
Yes.
I can hear you, but you can't hear me.
I can hear you. Hello.
Okay. I'm using the radio.
Okay. We're going to come back to you, Mick. Just turn your radio off if you can, and then I'll come back to you because I'm interested in your story. Zoe in Queensland, you changed your whole name.
Hi, Natasha.
Hello. Why did you change your entire name?
Natasha.
Yes, hello, can you hear me?
Hi.
We might have a little problem with the line, so I'll come back to the calls in just a tick. Stilgherrian, how do people react to you day to day, to your name? Are people endlessly curious, and does that drive you nuts?
If I'm in a hurry, it drives me nuts because just this week I've been covering a conference here in San Francisco, and so I'm meeting lots of people and I feel like I've explained it about 350 times every day. Look, I think the thing that always pleases me about human nature is almost everyone is perhaps surprised at first because they haven't encountered it before, but then there's a genuine curiosity and a warmth about it. Mm. You know, you very rarely get the, oh, that's weird. You get that online a bit, but really people are quite interested and want to know the story. And
but you've encountered some issues from various bureaucracies, and given that you're an online, you exist in the online space, very much a big part of your day and life is existing in the online space. You've had
Indeed.
Some big challenges there too. Tell us.
Absolutely, because as more and more of our lives become computer mediated, we have to put up with whatever software systems have been put in place. And, some programmers are better than others. Some programmers are aware of the huge variety of naming practices in different cultures around the world, and some simply are not. So you often run into databases where there are two name fields, first name and last name, or given name and family name, or however they call it, and there has to be something in both fields or it won't accept your registration.
So now, what happens?
Well, sometimes there's a workaround. Now, look, if it's in something that doesn't matter, I'm subscribing to an online newsletter, I'll just double the name up, put it in both fields and be done with it. Some systems have a workaround so that you, when they're sorting a list, you come up, in my case, Stilgherrian under the S's. And then in the first name field, you put FNU, which stands for First Name Unknown. And that sounds great until you realise that if the FBI or the police are doing a telephone intercept, what in the US is called a wiretap, if they just hear someone being referred to as Smith and they don't know who Smith is, then in the transcript that's FNU Smith. So you're the kind of suspect until the FBI can figure out who you are. So from a bureaucratic sense, the US Department of Homeland Security lumps me in with the criminal suspects.
Oh, the great inflexibility of systems.
Look, I will put a shout out to Medicare and Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade for passports. Don't blink an eyelid. It's just all part of the system and just works. But then they have to deal with everyone.
Inclusive bureaucracies here in Australia. I think we've got the lines up working again. Mick in New South Wales, you took your wife's name when you got married.
Yes, I did about 20 years ago.
Now, why did you do that?
Well, at the time, I was sort of thinking I wanted to show something for her because she was marrying me and leaving her estate and whatever. So we decided, well, I chose about a month before the wedding. We kept it pretty secret and said that's what we want to do. But we kept it a secret up until the wedding, and then we wanted to turn around when we announced the names to see what the rest of the crowd
What was the reaction?
Well, I had it broke down into thirds. We had a third jumping for joy. They thought it was fantastic. A third saying, he can't do that. And then another third thinking they've written the wrong names on the checks.
And just briefly, but since then, how have things gone? I mean, this was 20 years ago. It's probably more common for men to do that now.
Yeah, I think it is because I know of a couple of other people who've done it. I also, when I was working in another state, I employed another Mick, and it wasn't until after I employed him I found out he'd taken his wife's name as well. But his was for different reasons, which I won't go into.
Thanks for the call, Mick. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Zoe in Queensland,
Hi.
Welcome back. You changed your whole name. Tell us.
I did. My original name was Christine Johnson. And in the mid-20s, I changed my first name to Zoe by common usage. You could just change it in those days. And then later on, due to feminism, a group of us women in Canberra decided that we wanted to change our surnames because the system lost women down through history because of the patriarchal line. We didn't want to take our mother's maiden name because that was her father's name. We wanted a name that was uniquely ours, that spoke about us, that went before us, as your name does go before you, in the way of interviews, in the way of when you send in a job application or you write something, your name is out there before you.
Mm.
So it's really important that it conveys something. We felt it was important that it conveyed something about you. And Christine Johnson just wasn't doing it for me because it was just so beige. And what didn't convey who I really was. And Zoe, to me, I chose Zoe because it was it sounded like a strong feminist, gutsy name to me. And then Feather was my nickname at school. And that also conveyed the light, creative, frivolous part of me. And then Zillis was just this magic word that just spoke like it had magical qualities about it. And wherever I go and wherever I am...
So you went from Christine Johnson to Zoe Feather Zillis.
Yes.
Wow.
I did. And everybody loves that name, including my family. All my family like that name now. They were a little bit resistant in the beginning, but only for probably about 3 to 6 months. The worst person held out for 6 months, but only they agreed that I had a right to change my name, and they understood why I did it. My mum had a number of marriages, and each time in my childhood I became somebody else, and then I became somebody else, and then I became somebody, and I'm thinking, hello, like, this is me we're talking
about. So you got to define yourself. Thanks for that lovely story, Zoe.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it very much. Hugh in New South Wales, you have a particular story of changing your name.
It was really all about acceptance and not being seen to be different. The background is that I arrived here as a migrant child in 1950 as a displaced person along with my family under the International Refugee Organization sponsorship. And if I can take your attention to that SBS show that's been showing, Go Back to Where You Came From, those very words are seared in my psyche from those days. In other words, of course, one wasn't necessarily terribly welcomed. And so a few short years later, when I was naturalized and I had the opportunity to change my first and middle name from Hugo Romero to Hugh Ronald, that's precisely what I did for those very reasons.
Do you miss your name?
Well, I do, actually. And the irony these days is, you know, my adult daughter reminds me that now it's quite trendy to be the daughter of a migrant, you know. So we've sort of come a long way since those days.
How funny, isn't it, how things go round? What comes around goes around. Hugh, thank you very much.
No worries. Bye.
Appreciate it. Deanne in Melbourne, you simply couldn't wait to get married to change your name.
Hello, Natasha. Lovely to talk to you.
Likewise.
Oh, yes, Natasha. I have a first name and a second name that proved to be really problematic when my parents immigrated back in 1966 to Australia. And so my first name is Deanne, but it's spelled D-I-A-N-E. So I constantly got Diane.
Of course you did.
And then I had a surname that was really unusual. And I thought, oh, give me the day when I can get married and have a surname like Green or Brown or Smith. I was even willing to settle to Smith. Because, you identify so strongly with your name, or at least some of us do. And it was just such a problem.
I wonder if you did end up marrying someone with a complicated or easy name.
Yes, I did.
A complicated name.
No.
An easy name.
Excellent. Straightforward Anglo-Saxon name.
Oh, well, there you go. Deanne, thanks very much.
Thanks, Natasha.
This is Life Matters. It's our Friday talkback, and we're talking about what's in a name. So much of ourselves is wrapped up and invested in the name that we're given, or the name that we give ourselves. And over the week, we've done a few name-related stories, and we've had some great yarns coming in about how people have come to get the names that they have. Amanda Gordon, clinical psychologist Amanda Gordon is my guest, as is Stilgarian, joining us from San Francisco. Amanda, this whole discussion about changing your name, adopting your partner's name, particularly after marriage, there was a trend, as we've heard, away from women doing that. I sometimes wonder whether there's a trend back to doing that amongst some younger women.
Look, I see that whole variety within my practice, and anecdotally we see the whole variety of what it is. I think with later marriages, which seem to be so common, women don't want to give up their name because they feel they've formed their identity now. For women who were traditionally married much younger, perhaps before they had their degree, before they'd established themselves in the workforce or whatever, it was much easier to change their name. And I think that played a big part in it. Now women are getting credentials of their own, if you like. If they start getting credentials in one name, they don't necessarily want to change their name. They want to continue to build that identity that was them and continues to be them. You know, I've listened to some of the stories about people who have made choices about changing their names, and often it's because the identity that they had before wasn't entirely satisfactory, didn't give them what they wanted, which was usually a sense of inclusion, a sense of belonging, a sense of I'm part of this. And many people, I think, change their names so that they belong to the community that they want so desperately. I think it's funny when I listen, I mentioned my maiden name was Jones, but because I'm so ethnic looking and blatantly ethnic, and my name Jones was only of one generation anyway, teachers would constantly say to me, oh, is that spelled J-O-A-N-S?
Oh.
They couldn't believe it would be Jones because I didn't look like a Jones at all. So my name was inconsistent with my looks, was inconsistent with my ethnic heritage, but it was me and it was my identity. And, you know, and I was Jonesy to my friends.
Well, what about, just before we let you go, what about the confusion that a couple of generations hence from now are going to have with all those hyphenated names coming on board?
So, I just wonder about two generations, whether they have to have four hyphens.
I know.
It's very confusing, and I watch it already with my nieces and nephews and the confusion that's going to arise. And fascinatingly, I'm finding that many of them whose parents in very feminist terms, if you like, gave their children hyphenated names so that they would hold the mother's name as well, the girls are getting married and switching to their husbands' names. Mm. You know, it's like it's all too hard. How are we going to sort this out? It's easier if our kids just have one name. So I do think that for many people, it actually was more trouble than it was worth to have the cumbersome hyphenated names. They knew who their mum was. They knew who their dad was. They didn't need the name to prove that that was their mum.
Yes, we got a tweet from Linda Foskey saying, my stepchildren were not given middle names so they could choose their own. One chose her mother's maiden name. So there you go, giving your kids some choice is a nice way of doing it, isn't it? Amanda, thank you so much for joining us on the program this morning.
You're welcome, Natasha.
Amanda Gordon, Senior Clinical Psychologist and Director of Armchair Psychology in Sydney. And we're talking what's in a name today on our Friday Talkback. The number to call is 1300 225 76 1300 call RN. Our board might be full. If it is and you're having trouble getting through, an alternative sometimes is our listener feedback line, 0283 1430 0283 1430. So let's come to some of your calls. Deborah in Victoria, tell us what you want to say. What's your story?
I'm a researcher at Swinburne University of Technology, and I've recently done some research into parents' decision-making about children's surnames.
Right, and what have you found?
Well, we did some queries of the data that's held by the Victorian Registry of Births, Deaths and Marriages. And so what we found is that 55% of Victorian children have a surname that matches that of their mother and their father. But the next most common pattern is the children to be given the same surname as their father, but for their mother to have a different surname.
Yes, and I've had friends who have made that decision. You know, they've kept their own surnames but given the kids one parent's name. And that's an interesting decision too, because that's about whether, I guess, you continue the patrilineal or the matrilineal line, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think the thing that interested us the most is that about 90% of children whose parents have different surnames have the father's surname. So we're doing some more work into trying to find out, you know, what's the reasoning around that? Why is the father's name so popular when the woman's made the decision to keep her own?
Okay, I'll be interested to hear more about that. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Deborah in Victoria doing some interesting research there. Perhaps you are one of those people that you kept your own name but you've given your kids one of your names. Interested in some of the rationale that you have made to do that. Give us a call, 1300 225 76. Julianne, I think it is, in Victoria. What's your, what, now tell us about your a name that you wanted to talk about.
On Monday, James Carlton, I think it was, said that he was nearly called Brabazon, B-R-A-B-A-Z-O-N. I had an uncle who was Brabazon Richard and a brother who was Richard Brabazon. They were known respectively as Dick and Rick. Brabazon is a surname which occurs in my father's family somewhere, and I believe that it's of Norman origin.
Right, okay. Well, look, thank you for that. We actually have a family history researcher coming up on the show shortly, so we might get some interesting yarns around that. We don't know. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Excellent. Barbara in New South Wales, your daughter's got your surname, your son's got your hubby's name.
That's right. That's what we decided to do. Our name, particularly my name, was not going to be passed on. There were no grandchildren around amongst my cousins. So the name, a fairly unusual name, and a family Bible, was going to sort of be lost. So, and it was just important to both of us that both of our names were kept going. So we decided that that's what we'd do.
So why girls getting the girl's name, boys getting the boy's name?
Well, it wasn't going to be that way. We decided that the firstborn would take the same name as the gender of the parent, and then the second child, whether it was a girl or the same name, the same gender, would take the other person's name. So we could have ended up with a boy taking my husband's name and then another boy taking my name. It didn't matter. The first child was going to be the decider, and then the second child was going to be whatever the other one didn't get.
Boy, it gets complex, doesn't it?
But it's interesting because it was very simple. It just turned out to be very simple, and every now and again the kids have had a little bit of their peers saying, oh, why have you got a different name from your sister? And they just say, oh, that's the way. And my husband said, why don't you say to them, why have you got the same name as your sibs? So, and that's it. There's no problem. Nobody has any problem with it, and the kids really like it. And
well, there you go. I'm glad it worked out. Barbara, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Now, look, I just wanted to read you an interesting... we got a Facebook comment I wanted to share with you and I just don't have it with me, but what they did is they decided to... I know a couple who created a... That's right, Michaela writes, I know a couple who created a new surname from a blend of their existing names. It was unique, to say the least, and hard to pronounce. I wonder why you'd do that, actually create an even more complicated name. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Stilgherrian is with us. Stilgherrian is a tech and politics commentator and writer and blogger and broadcaster. Stilgherrian, are you still there from San Fran?
I hope I am, Natasha.
You are indeed. So you were talking before about the way in which bureaucracies are rather inflexible to your mononym,
yes,
rather than a pseudonym. It's a mononym. But you actually encountered a particularly inflexible online system, Google Plus, the kind of social networking platform for Google,
yes,
which has been a bit of a failure, and maybe this is why. What happened when you attempted to enter your name into their system?
Well, there's a bit of a backstory here. Google were insisting that people using the Google Plus social network post things under their real name, so their actual legal name. Now, at the time, they were saying this is because we want to make this a kind of civilized place without the kind of internet trolls and nasty comments and so on. Now, I don't think that actually works, but that's another topic. Now, they ran into a lot of flack, and it was even divisive within Google, because a lot of people post online either with an existing pseudonym and an existing identity, even if they make their actual legal name known. They use a pseudonym, a pen name, or they might have a very real reason for not wanting to post under their real name, whether they're, say, writing about their experiences as a rape victim or about being gay in the police force, but they're actually the only police officer in a small country town. And so, you know, that would be awkward if that was known and so on. But in my case, you know, this is my legal name. I've used it consistently for years. I post under it. So I said, right, I will now put in my name. Now, when I went to do so, I was a bit late and someone had flagged my name as unusual or weird. So when I tried to log into Google Plus, it said, your name does not meet our community guidelines. Please change it, and an edit button.
Clunk.
It struck me.
Total invalidation of who you are.
Indeed. Now, I wrote a blog post which uses some quite harsh language, the C word in the headline even, and it got kind of worse from there, if you can imagine. But it was, to me, the rudest and most arrogant thing to have done, and it was the rudest way of putting this that I've encountered in more than 30 years, and I said so. And it struck me as completely ham-fisted for one of the largest global companies. It's been in business for more than 13 years. They should know all of the variety of naming practices, because anyone who's programmed a system for a bank or a hospital or you know, anything really, you know, will have encountered this stuff before.
Yes, get with it, Google. Now, you're in the US at the moment.
That's right.
And you've just tweeted to us while you were listening to some of those calls about research in the US with names on resumes showed innate racism in how they were perceived by employers. Just explain briefly what you wanted to share there.
Well, this was a fascinating study done a few years ago that some researchers, and I believe it's written up in the book Freakonomics, which is kind of a couple of mad economists writing about all sorts of things. That's not a recent book. It's about some years old. But the researchers put together resumes for jobs that they saw being advertised. And they prepared, you know, say the job was as a computer programmer, they prepared a resume of someone who would legitimately, you know, be eligible for that job. And then they sent different versions of it to employers. And one set had a name that was, you know, obviously looked black, Kwame Williams, say. You know, you would assume that someone with that name.
But same qualifications.
Black. With some qualifications.
But same qualifications.
Same qualifications. The one Chester so-and-so. Yeah. So the clear message came back. Those with a black-sounding name were far less likely to be shortlisted and called in for an interview. And the only difference in the resumes was the name. And they did this with hundreds and hundreds of resumes to various jobs. So, you know, it was a very clear statistical message. Your name was an indicator and could, you know, really hurt your chances of getting a job. And we see that with migrants adopting a name of the culture of the country they migrate to.
And that's right. We heard from a caller before. And we've had a few tweets. Stokely writes, my hyphenated surname was mum's maiden name and dad's last name. As a feminist, I love it, but only use it on legal documents. Wolf writes, we went with my wife's surname as part of the name because it was gender neutral, Dale, and my surname. So there you go. A few interesting tweets coming in. At RN Life Matters is where we are on Twitter. You know, our surnames, even our first names, are much more than just our own, as we've established this morning on our Life Matters Talkback. They carry a long history, often over many generations before us. This is, of course, the passion of family historians and genealogists, and as they trace back through our lineages. And one such family historian is Megan Gibson. She's a family tree researcher. She's been one of the researchers for Who Do You Think You Are, the TV series on SBS, and she's the author of How to Get More Family Tree Time. Welcome to Life Matters, Megan.
G'day, Natasha.
G'day to you. Look, you know, Shakespeare's Juliet asked, what's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. You've got your own interpretation on this and say a rose by another name might smell as sweet, but an ancestor by any other name is just downright frustrating for family historians.
Yeah, look, it might be as poetic as Shakespeare, but it's absolutely the truth.
Why can names be such a vexed issue for a family tree researcher?
Well, look, I guess for people researching their family tree, the name is really the key to unlock a lot of those mysteries and the things that they're searching for. I guess there's a little more to it once you get into it. Things like location can come into play. And that also, I think, absolutely connects in with identity and the things we've been listening to this morning. But no, names are crucial because, you know, in the pre-internet age, for those of us who remember that, you know, we didn't have these easily accessible records and documentation of our lives, and we really only rely on records and things that have survived through the centuries to, you know, to really indicate that whole lineage. So the key really is the name to start with.
And so you come across some interesting brick walls and dead ends and potholes in your travels sometimes, don't you? Over the years in your research, what have been some of the common and perhaps less common, more eccentric reasons for why people have changed their names?
Look, nothing amazes me anymore. I used to think, wow, that's a bit weird. But then the more you research and you delve into other people's trees, I guess it's all because, you know, everyone's human, and people, I think, forget, they look at family trees and think of them as, you know, statistics or, you know, names, dates and places or certificates. But they're people, they're human. So for whatever reason you can possibly think of that perhaps yourself or someone today would want to change their name, it's pretty valid. I think only the hairstyles change, really. It's all about human nature.
But what's some other reasons? Because certainly some have rather shady histories, yeah, and they decide to kind of, I guess, cover them up as best as they can.
I mean, I guess the most obvious example in Australia would be our convict history. You know, of course, for such a long time, it was something that was to be, you know, not talked about and hidden away and disguised. But then, of course, recently, you know, in the last few decades, it's actually become quite a badge of honour. So people are madly trying to, you know, to find out what they can about their convict past. It's sort of a thing to be proud of these days. So things change and fashions change as well. I think people change their names. It sort of fits into two camps, really. There's, you know, some very valid reasons to change a name, perhaps, you know, escaping from a bad, you know, even potentially, say, a domestic violence situation, something like that, where you really do need to start again and need that change. The other reason, of course, can go from eccentric to obvious with, you know, covering up crimes or, you know, trying to... I had a particular ancestor who deserted his family and ran away to join the theatre troops in the goldfields in Western Australia. Yeah. So I had an interesting thing about him, if I may. He had quite an unusual surname, Albinson, Albinson, which was great because he was relatively easy to find in records up to the point where he disappeared. Interestingly, the name that he chose to change was Albertson. So a very, you know, not a really a rare name, so he's done it the other way around.
Yeah.
You know, I think what we have to remember is that...
I'll keep that in mind next time I need to run away to the circus.
Yeah. But I think what we have to keep in mind about all this is people don't do these or make these decisions based on what are the people in three generations going to think about this as far as tracing me. They're just living their lives and adapting their names to their circumstances and, you know, for whatever reasons.
Well, hang on the line with us. I might come to some calls because the board is chockers. It's our Friday Life Matters Talkback. Natasha Mitchell with you. I'm joined by Megan Gibson, a family tree researcher, and also Stilgarian joining us from San Francisco. Jennifer in New South Wales.
Hi, Natasha.
You have some regrets about not using your family name. Tell us.
I do, yes. My partner and I had been together for 20-odd years and never got around to getting married. His surname's Cox, mine is Park, and we joked about you're never going to hyphenate those two or even blend them. And then pregnant with my first child, we just very easily decided that the child, boy or girl, would have my surname. But just before he was born, having a conversation with my mother-in-law, and she said, I feel like I need to speak for my dead husband. And I just caved. I just thought, oh, my God, there's so much baggage there. So when the child was born, it was his boy, my son, and we gave him my partner's surname. And a day after his first birthday, my father died. And I suddenly realised that my name had died with him because my sister had changed her surname, her children had her husband's name, and now my child, you know, no longer had my surname, and so my name had died with my father. And I've thought, you know, a bit since then about just whacking it into his birth certificate or somehow just trying to keep the name alive, but it surprised me that there was so much emotion about it, and I understood what my mother-in-law was at, well, mother-outlaw, what she was trying to convey.
Yes, gosh. Yeah. Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Thanks.
Jane in New South Wales, you took your hubby's name.
I did, Natasha. My husband and I got married in 1979, and it wasn't really the norm at that point to keep your own name, so I changed my name, but I was the first amongst my family and a lot of my friends to get married, and all of them after me kept their own names. And it really just, for me, never quite went away, this urge to still have my own name. And just listening to your previous guest talking about family history, would have been my great-grandmother had the same name that I had. And when I was growing up, you know, I was to get the portrait and I was to get the brooch. And I think, just reflecting after hearing that woman speak, that I had a very strong sense of connection and identification, I suppose, to her. And so after 20 years of marriage, I thought, you know, I'm going to have to either do this or I'm going to have to put it to bed and never think about it again. And so I spoke to my husband and asked him how he might feel if I changed my name back to my own name. And I spoke to my kids, who were at that point in their mid to early teens, and there was a lot of support. My husband said, well, I always thought it was a big ask to expect women to just change their names.
Oh, how lovely.
I know. My husband's been extremely supportive of everything I've ever done.
Yeah, how lovely. That's just so lovely, isn't it?
Yeah.
Congratulations to you
and
your hubby. That's a lovely story. Jane, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Gee, gosh, so much emotion wrapped up in our names, isn't there? Emma in Queensland, tell us your story.
Hi, Natasha.
Hi there.
I'm adopted, and I always knew from a very young age that I was adopted. But I didn't know my name, and my name, of course, is Emma, and I've always had that as my reference point. But when I found out my name was Belinda as my original name, it really shifted the way in which, I suppose, I looked at myself. Not that I, you know, have changed in any sense the word, but it was a real sort of shock that somebody had named me a very different person, I suppose. The identity from Belinda to Emma is very, very different in my head. And so I did a bit of research on my family history, my original family history, and made sure that my children's names were reflecting a little bit of me. And so they have a Hebrew name as their first name. And they have their surname, but the Hebrew name was very important for me, and my husband was incredibly supportive as well.
Wonderful. Thank you, Emma. That in some way you were able to reclaim some of your history.
I was very fortunate.
Imprinted on your children. I really appreciate that story. Thank you.
Thanks,
Megan Gibson, just briefly, there's a lot of pain wrapped up in the history of our names, isn't there?
Yes, look, there can be. And but one thing I would like to mention too, I'm always very aware.
We might have to come back to you. That line's a bit crummy, isn't it? Sorry, Megan, hold that thought for us, because I would like to come back to you on that one. Having a little phone line problem today. Let's have another call. Carol in Canberra. Hi.
Oh, g'day. How's it going?
Very well. Tell us about your surname.
Well, it's Cutmore. From the Armidale Moree region, because I'm Indigenous and come from there. But the sad thing is that in around about the 1860s, I'm told, the marriage laws changed and you had to have a surname. So apparently our great-great-great just took the name from the property they were, you know, allowed to live around. And so that's how we got it. And I found out just a couple of years ago, and I'm in my 50s now, and I was shocked and felt so empty. I guess a bit like, like adopted people, you sort of suddenly think, oh, I'm baseless, I don't know where I came from. And, of course, we lost a lot of our traditions and such very quickly. And so here I am with this British background, but with no solid base of all that wonderful history.
Yeah, maybe there's another way you can reclaim that history. Work on it, sister, work on it.
Interesting, thank you.
Carol, thanks for that.
No worries.
This is the Life Matters Friday Talkback, and I wonder if we've got Megan back on the line. Not yet, yep, and we'll come to Anna in Queensland. Hi, Anna, you changed both names and a birth date.
Yes, actually. I had a really violent ex-partner and had to change both names and my date of birth.
Goodness.
And my children actually made up our surname.
They made it up?
Yeah.
So that was a truly democratic process.
Yeah, it was. So really we're a family historian's nightmare.
But in some ways it liberated you from your history.
Yes, it did actually, and I've been able to achieve highly since then. It's like freed me up. Mm. It's given me a second chance.
Well done for that.
Yeah. Thank you, Natasha.
Thank you for the call. And there you go. Some people have very radical situations that they really do need to change their name to stay safe and move on as much as you can. Megan Gibson, family tree researcher, back on the line. This there again, we have a history of pain wrapped up in people's stories.
Yes, look, absolutely. It's part of life and everyone's story and everyone's family tree. There was something I'd like to point out. With adopted people, of course, there's some extra complications and sensitivities. But also, too, don't forget that we're really only relying on third-hand or worse information in many cases with our family trees. And so while, you know, we do our best to check everything and check multiple sources and try and gather as much information to ensure that what we're finding and recording, is the real picture. I think there's always a bit of a grain of salt in there, and sometimes you're never quite sure. So people who perhaps really firmly believe and attach themselves to such to such a documented history and so on, there's always, to me, a grain of salt that while you can do what you can to try and prove it, that that they might be in the same situation and so potentially, pardon the pun, barking up the wrong tree.
Oh, I think a name like Stilgherrian will probably be a blessing for you in terms of family tree research. Stilgherrian, back to you in San Francisco, joining us on Skype. Just briefly, there's been a very interesting debate unfold this week about the use of pseudonyms online. There's been a case of trolls, and we'll find out what they are in a minute, but trolls or bullies online, basically, targeting an individual. And a woman TV presenter has ended up in hospital this week in a state of distress. We won't go into the particular case, but the point is that people use pseudonyms online for many reasons, and one of the reasons is to target people and bully people and post aggro comments on blogs and websites and the like. What's your view on this? Because 7:30 Report host Lee Sales tweeted yesterday she'd like to see, for example, Twitter demand that all users tweet under their actual identities. What do you think?
Yep. I think Lee Sales is very, very, very wrong there. Look, this debate happens every time something bad happens on the internet and we don't immediately know who they are. And to suggest that we have everything that you do online have their real name attached, and this is actually, Google's point with their Google Plus network. This is what they want to do. There are so many reasons that people will not, be safe if they use their full legal name online. And that, we've talked about some of them. We've heard some of the terrible stories of the situations people are escaping and change their names to get away with that. But there's also little things like if a public servant is not meant to be commenting about political matters in their role as a public servant, then how can they participate in our online world? How can anyone with some reason to keep their real name and their address and so on hidden participate in the global online conversation if we insist they have to do that to take part?
That said, it's undeniable, Stilgherrian, that the anonymity that a pseudonym brings has allowed a particular kind of nastiness to thrive
online
forums.
It hasn't.
Because don't you think so?
No.
But people are hiding behind the invisibility of a pseudonym in order to be, bastards, basically.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you said that word first, and I'd ramp it up to another word, but it's a little early in the day in Australia. I realise that, Natasha. But no, because when the internet was a small place, only tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, people had an online handle. And the way that evolved is originally when you had a username on the internet, it was limited to 8 characters, 8 letters. And so that's why everyone invented a little internet handle. They had to, technically. And, we could work out where they are by tracing their internet address, because everyone in the early days of the internet was technically skilled. They had to be. It didn't stop people being the bastards. And what stops people being bastards is the sense that they will be punished for it. And this is all documented a decade and a half ago, by Sherry Turkle, a sociologist, in her book Life on the Screen. It's simply that when people are in their own space, their own home, they feel safe. They can do things online and there is no immediate retribution, either
physically. Yes, so we need some form of retribution for those bullies online, don't we?
Social, and not just delete their comments from the forum, but explain and have a public process so that they are named and people see that explanation and understand why it's not acceptable.
And we wouldn't hear from many in Syria, for example, if they couldn't use pseudonyms. Just briefly back to Megan Gibson, because we're running out of time. Megan, pseudonyms, is that a bit of a minefield for a family tree researcher?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Unless it's documented, for example, I had an ancestor who did, but we knew what was going on, so that made it easier. If the focus here is just purely on, you know, tracing your family tree. It can be. I realise the necessity for it in some situations, but from a family tree point of view, yeah, sure, it complicates things. But again, it comes back to some other form of documentation. If that's your focus, is to actually find out who they were and to get a bit more of a picture about them.
And we wouldn't have George Eliot if we didn't have pseudonyms. Max in New South Wales, you've changed your name.
Yeah, I haven't actually legally changed it, but since I was 16 and I'm 42 now, I became known as Max.
Margaret, yeah?
Yeah, and when in the 70s, I just had the Nana name, you know. It was so embarrassing at school and got a hard time, and everyone else was Bridget and Sharon, and that seemed much cooler. When I was 16, I just chose Max, and I'm not really sure why. It may not have been because I loved Mel Gibson, or, you know, it just seemed very
it
cool.
It worked for you. Thank
and
you,
it was
Max.
Very contrived, but, you know.
Well, it works for me too. It's a good name.
In a call centre too, and I have to say my name 800 times a day, and I get 90% of people just say it off the tongue and say it straight back to me and are very accepting, but every now and then you'll get someone who'll go, Max?
That's a boy's name.
A weird name, and they get really quite head up, and it's quite amazing.
There you go. Thanks, Max, very much. Ken in Queensland, your surname is Bull.
Yes, it's Bull, and I named my daughter after my wife's surname.
Did you? Why was that?
My father was largely a stranger. He came from Sydney, and it was his second marriage, and he was a stranger from when I was about 4 years of age. And with a name like Bull, I didn't have a family connection to the name in that regard. I have a brother by that name, but that's all. And I simply decided my wife's surname is Moriarty. I've been published on surnames, the meanings of surnames. And Moriarty means descended from the Vikings. And I thought, you know, Moriarty...
Delicious.
Yeah, it's a much better name. We were about 40. I thought she might be our only child. But I thought if we have a boy, I'd probably name him Bull anyway. I wasn't sure about that. But she was a girl, so she was Moriarty.
Well, that's a beautiful surname. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, right. There you go. Judy in Victoria. Tell us about your story. You had a son by egg donation, and that made your name decision rather interesting.
Yes, because we'd already decided he'd have my husband's name, last name, and we had given him a chosen name. But my egg donor was a relative, and so she was the daughter of my first cousin. And we decided we wanted a name that would connect us both, and that it would also connect my son when he grew up to his story. So we chose the name of what was her grandfather and my uncle, who had died in his 40s. So it was quite a nice just connection and pleased other members of our family, like my mother and her grandmother.
Thank you.
Well.
Thank you very much, Judy. So as we've illustrated today, names are incredibly complex and the decisions we make are incredibly complex and considered too. I'd like to thank our guests this morning, Stilgherrian. Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Natasha.
And keep tweeting some of your thoughts. I would have liked to have come to you a bit more. Politics and technology writer and broadcaster Stilgherrian. And we also heard from Amanda Gordon from Armchair Psychology. And Megan Gibson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Natasha.
Family tree researcher and also one of the researchers for Who Do You Think You Are, the TV series, and author of How to Get More Family Tree Time. She has a website. Today's program was produced by Gina McEwen, a sound engineer, Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. The rest of the team, star producers Jane Shields, Tracy Trumpf, Lindy Rain, and executive producer Julie Browning. Keep the conversation going, won't you, on our website, abc.net.au/radionational/lifematters. Life Matters is on Facebook. There's our Twitter name, at RN Life Matters. Many of you have been tweeting throughout the show today. Looking forward to your company on Monday. Saying bye for now. Have a beautiful weekend from me, Natasha Mitchell. Stay with RN.
Ever run away from home as a kid or fantasize about doing so? Wes Anderson's new film Moonrise Kingdom is that fantasy come to life. The one in which everyone realizes how mean they've been to you and they're sorry. We also meet William Eubank, who built a spaceship in his backyard to make the visually astonishing Love.
That's Movie Time with Julie Rigg and me, Jason DiRosso. You can download or stream this program from the RN website.